And good morning. It is 10 o'clock this Wednesday morning. Time once again for the Kenai Conversation. I'm your host, Shaylin Cochran. And this week, well, rather a sad note to begin the show, but hoping that the hour will provide some laughs and some fond memories. We're here today to remember our departed friend, Dr. Alan Boris, who died Monday at the age of 72. Rather unexpected, of course, for anyone who was touched, the innumerable folks around the peninsula over the years who were touched by Alan's work and just his affable zest for life, I suppose. Happy to be joined in the studio this morning with a longtime, I don't know, how would you describe it, Bill? A longtime friend, co-worker, developer of devious plans with Alan. Bill Holt is with us in the studio this morning. Good to see you, Bill.
Yeah, thank you. It's good to be here, Shaylin.
Always good to talk to you. A bit later, hoping to connect with Dr. James Carey over the phone. He's up in Fairbanks, a longtime colleague of Dr. Boris's. Also, some tentative plans. Hoping to hear from Mr. George Hawley a bit later this hour as well. 394-6397 will be the number today if you have some fond memories of Dr. Boris you'd like to share with us. Again, 394-6397, the number to call, 394-6397. And there's, we could go for days and days and days. Dr. Boris has spent half a century building an incredible legacy here on the Kenai Peninsula and well beyond. We want to dedicate some of the show, of course, though, to remembering Dr. Boris's voice. And to that end, we have we've gone sort of through the archives here and picked out a few portions of interviews and some presentations and some lectures that Dr. Boris has given over the years that we've been lucky enough to record and be able to air in other forms here on KDLL. But what better time than now to revisit some of these? And I want to start with one here. This is a relatively recent interview that I did with Dr. Boris about a year ago. Well, it was almost exactly a year ago. And a little backstory to this, we'd had a guest cancel on us for a regular episode of the Kenai Conversation. And Dr. Boris, never with any shortage of things to talk about and always just such a deep well of information, historical, anthropological, and otherwise, was more than happy and very gracious to give us some time, sort of on short notice about a year ago, to talk about, as we get into this transition into winter, to talk about a culture of the North. And this is a theme and a topic that Dr. Boris spent a lot of time on, and very much, I hesitate to use the word preach, but he was certainly a proponent of developing a robust and strong and sustainable culture of the North. And we're going to start the hour today playing a little clip from Alan and having him describe for him what it means to be in a culture of the North.
Well, we're used to looking at maps that portray North America on one side, and distant, far away is Europe and Asia and so on. If you look at a polar projection, however, the North becomes clearer. I have a map in my office of a polar projection, and I look at it frequently to give me a perspective. So we're close. Alaska is close to Scandinavia, certainly close to northern Canada, not far from Russia. Sarah Palin was probably right about that. And it's true. So what do we share? Obviously, we share a climate. Climate's changing, but nevertheless, we share a climate of the North. In particular, we share the light of the North. And in that regard, we can share it with the South, as the Deep South. I mean South Pole as well. But the light is really one of our defining characteristics. We're coming on the dark season. And as everyone knows, in the summer, it's light. What a lot of people don't seem to think of is that we have the same amount of light as Miami. Just comes in different amounts, different times of the year. It's the light and the landscape. And I think in terms of the North, the other thing we have is a closer affinity and a closer history with Indigenous people. And through that, understanding what it takes to adapt to a place sustainably over long periods of time. So in some of the traditional stories, Gudjun is a good guy. But in other stories, he's a bad guy. This caused me a lot of puzzlement because in our stories, our Western stories, the good guy's a good guy and the bad guy's a bad guy and there's no crossover, right? We know who the good guy is, wears a white hat. We know the black hat goes on the bad guy, and that's what I learned. And it's part of a mythology that involves very clear good and bad. But in Dena'ina mythology, Dena'ina stories, as Peter Kalifornsky would say, there's good and bad in all things and in all people. No one's all good, no one's all bad. The idea is to suppress the bad and enhance the good. So Gudjun is one of those characters. There were, however, some characters that were absolute evil. Gilyak, Nantina, one other one whose name I can't remember right now, who always appear as evil. In the sense that their behavior is chaotic. So what's evil? Chaos, unpredictability is evil. It's not so much that you know, so it's like bears, you know? There's a bear, but there's that bad bear. Chaos, that's chaos. And in fact, in some Dena'ina stories, the metaphor of evil is the crazed brown bear. So whereas our metaphor of evil is a bad metaphor, cold and dark. Cold and dark, metaphors of evil, the prince of darkness. There's 189 references in the Bible to cold or to dark as evil, for example. So October comes. And all the whining starts. So dark out. Then it gets worse. Then February or December hits. So dark out. I'm not saying that seasonal affective disorder is not a thing. It is. But I would submit that much of its cause is the metaphor that dark is evil. Nothing looks more dark than being inside a house looking out. But you step outside. Yeah. Moon's out. Stars are out. Glow off the snow. It's absolutely beautiful. It's not so bad anymore. Well, we've only been around for, what, 150 years? We, as our Western culture, we haven't had time to adjust to this. These are what I call mid-latitude values. Fine for cold and dark to be a metaphor of evil in Israel or Arizona. Not good in the north. If you want a good metaphor of evil, that unpredictable brown bear. Unpredictability is chaos.
And again, that's Dr. Boris talking a bit about the culture of the North and that particular interview done right around a year ago. And perhaps this is Dr. Carey giving us a call in right now. And there he is, Dr. James Carey joining us over the phone. Dr. Carey, thank you so much for being with us today. It's good to hear from you. For folks maybe who aren't familiar, Dr. Carey and Dr. Boris worked extensively for many, many years together on Native language projects, Native language revitalization projects, and those sorts of things. And Dr. Carey, we can get into that a little bit later. Joining us, so that you know, joining us in the studio here in Kenai, you're calling from Fairbanks, and thank you again so much for doing that. Joining us here in the studio is another longtime sort of colleague of Dr. Boris's, is Bill Holt. And Bill, you know, as we're getting into, we just played that clip about the culture of the North and such a a big part of that is wintertime and recreation, and Alan was such a proponent of those things during his lifetime, specifically at the Salteshi Trails, and I know that that's where you spent a lot of time working with him. I guess I don't really know. It's hard for me to even know what to ask. I guess what were your immediate thoughts when you heard the sad news?
Well, I think that my first thought was it was like a something that was I don't want to say meant to be, but it was somewhat expected. Alan has been having some health problems for quite a while, and I've been real aware that Alan seemed to be kind of making peace with a lot of things in his life. You know, he had been spending some time out on the trails doing things, and I realized that he was sort of, in a lot of ways, blessing the trails or allowing the trails to bless him. They were a real important part of his life, and he just seemed to be. Alan could be a real provocateur. He could really push your buttons, but he just seemed like he was, every time I was around, it exuded kind of a reverence for nature, and he exuded sort of a reverence for the work that he had done and the work that we had done together, and not just me, of course, it was everybody. So I just felt a real humbleness and humility in Alan. This last year, and it started dawning on me that he may not have 9 lives, and that was so. When I heard the news, I'd been talking to Penny often, and I had asked Penny to tell Alan that I was up there screwing around with something, and that he better wake up and get down here and kick my ass a little bit about what I was doing. So, but I really feel like it was. A place where we were expecting it to happen.
So. Yeah, and of course, and my apologies for not saying something to begin the show. Our deepest and most heartfelt condolences to Penny and the rest of the family. Such a tough time for them, and for so many of us. I've had the pleasure and the opportunity to interview Alan a number of times over the years, and spend a lot of time in that anthropology lab, sort of talking about just the world's problems. You could go in and you could talk to Alan about just about anything, really. And, another person, another voice that we wanted to include in the program today is that of Clark Fair. Folks might know Clark has written extensively for a number of publications, lifetime Kenai Peninsula resident. Not too long ago, did a major project on the 50th anniversary of Kenai Peninsula College. And, of course, we know Dr. Boris, a huge foundational instructor at Kenai Peninsula College. And Clark, very generous with his time, took and also wrote a letter to the editor in the Peninsula Clarion. Would recommend checking that out as well. But spoke with Clark a little bit yesterday, sort of just about, about meeting Dr. Boris and the effect that he's had on Clark's life. And let's take a listen now to Clark Fair discussing his relationship with Dr. Boris.
I met Alan in 1977, and so I've known him for just under 43 years. And he definitely helped shape my intellectual curiosity, and was an absolute inspiration to me.
I think he was that for a lot of people.
Yeah, when you start reading what people write, you realize that he touched almost uncountable number of lives, and that's powerful stuff. When Tony Lewis and I were putting together the 50-year history of KPC, the book. We spent a lot of time with Alan, among other people, and actually, Alan is now the fourth person that I can think of off the top of my head that we spoke to during that process who has since passed away. And we are very pleased that we got the opportunity to to speak to them about the foundation of the college. And I sent a note to Tony because Tony's now living in Japan. And what he said was, when he responded to me this morning, he said that there aren't too many people who can say that they have shaped a community and preserved a culture like Alan. He still had a lot to give, too, which makes his death even sadder. And I thought that was pretty well said.
He was one of the first people that, when I moved here, that I just sort of looked up to, you know, smile and a handshake and try to figure out some things that were going on. And what impressed me about him always was he was such a good listener, and he was always genuinely interested in what was going on, who he was speaking with, where they were from, what their story was. He was just a fantastic person to spend time with.
Yeah, he really was. Yeah, a lot of hours drifted by in the anthropology lab.
Oh, yeah.
Having long conversations with Alan.
Yeah. I've been thinking a lot about what that space was in that little office that he built over, you know, decades.
Right.
And that's a really special space for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was a safe place for a lot of people, but also a place where people didn't mind expressing a lot of different ideas, and where it didn't really matter who you were or where you came from, because all of your ideas had value. And he also had quite a memory for people who passed through his door over the years, so that he could, you know, recall who people were and what their background and their stories were. And they were constantly coming in and checking in and sharing, you know, updating their lives and sharing things that they'd discovered with him. And, you know, I think it's pretty obvious that he listened and that he read carefully and investigated thoroughly when he wrote on a lot of different topics for just, say, the Anchorage Daily News and
right.
the Dispatch. And even if, I mean, I'm sure that the people who disagreed with him, and there were plenty, you know, all you had to do was read the comments section after some of his columns, and you knew that there were people who philosophically and politically disagreed with him vehemently.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't think very many people could sit down and say he didn't do his homework.
Right.
Because he did. He may not have agreed with him, but he didn't say anything lightly. Even in conversation, there were moments where he would just sort of sit for a moment and think about something before he said it. He was not particularly impulsive. I personally never known him to be any other way.
Yeah.
And that goes all the way back to Introduction to Geology, January 1977. So, that's my experience with him.
Yeah. I bet that Intro to Geology class was a lot of fun back in those days.
It was a lot of fun. And I mentioned that in my letter to the editor, that even then, when it's not anthropology and where it's more scientific, fact-based methodology, he was getting us to see the world differently.
Right.
And, you know, I've lived my whole life on the Kenai Peninsula, and it's kind of a miracle when somebody can come along and say, why don't you look at it this way? You go, oh, wow.
Yeah, you know, that's really interesting. I suppose it does take someone who has a combination of not being from here and yet has spent a lot of time in a place to have not just the outsider's perspective, but to have the understanding of how to communicate that perspective to the people who have lived here their entire lives.
Yeah, I think that, one, he was a naturally keen observer
mm-hmm.
of the world around him and other people. And Second, I would say he was also a natural educator, someone who could find a way to help other people see what he could see. Because, you know, I've said this before, you know, I had a 20-year career in education myself, and not everybody who understands things, say a math teacher who is excellent at math but is not really a very good teacher because they can't help other people see things the way he or she sees things. You know, and Alan was gifted in that way, that he could help you see the things that he could see, and he could do it without making you feel stupid. I mean, it's a rare gift, and we all got to share it for a long time.
That was Clark Fair speaking about Dr. Alan Boris, the subject of our Kenai conversation this morning here on KDLL. Bill Holt joining us in the studio. And on the phone, we have Dr. James Carey is with us, all the way from Fairbanks. Are you still with us, Dr. Carey?
Yes, I enjoyed both Mr. Holt and Mr. Fair, their comments. And Anthropology Lab is really kind of legendary in that, you know, so many people, maybe from state agencies, homesteaders, people visiting again from returning to Kenai. It's just a real center for interesting, lively things, because other people would come in the middle of another conversation, and so they'd be included in the current conversation, and then their conversation might start. And see, I've been retired for a long time, since 1997 at UAF. The most interesting teaching I've done in the last 20 years is when I occasionally visit KPC. And there's something about the general atmosphere there that's very friendly, and free parking, and you know, you find yourself being greeted by the custodial staff or different people introduce themselves to me. And then the classes, when I taught in one of Alan's Cook Inlet Anthropology classes or the Dena'ina language classes, they're really quite interesting, and we can cut across the span of technical subjects and abstract subjects like about Dena'ina grammar. I appreciate the general atmosphere at KPC and the types of students, now these lifelong learners that were maybe teenagers when I first met them in Tyonek, who are now, you know, very much part of the survival of Dena'ina, the reiteration, the identity, and other aspects of that, and artwork, and singing, and special hobbies people have with fish processing, salmon knowledge, or botany, and these kinds of things.
We know, you know, Dr. Boris was so instrumental in exposing folks who weren't familiar with those native cultures and cultural traditions to those native cultures and cultural traditions. And before we get too much farther down the line, I want to give out the numbers again. Would love to hear other stories, folks from around the community. If you have a way that you would like to remember Dr. Boris today, 394-6397 is the number. Again, 394-6397. And speaking of the efforts about language preservation and promoting that, I want to play a clip here from another interview we did. This was with Alan and also with Sandra Shaganoff-Stewart and Joel Isaac, and we were talking about the language program, essentially, at Kenai Peninsula College, and Alan shared this story of visiting Cay Beach Elementary with Peter Kalifornsky, with whom he worked extensively, about whom he wrote extensively, and we can talk about that hopefully in a little bit, but I want to play this little story that Alan shared about going to Cay Beach Elementary with Peter Kalifornsky.
Well, Dena'ina is one of the world's most endangered languages. And it happened for a number of reasons, but one of the primary reasons was the policy of the federal government territorial schools and later schools to extinguish native languages. So people were punished. Children were punished for speaking their language in schools, and the punishment usually meant having their mouths washed out with soap. Girls were with skirts were meant to kneel on rock salt, and an Dena'ina scholar, elder, now deceased, Peter Kalifornsky, told me the story of him being beaten for speaking his Dena'ina language. When he was still alive, so this was quite a while ago, Peter Kalifornsky and I went to Kalifornsky Beach Elementary, just down the road from the college here. And his book had just come out, so this was 1991. And they were having some kind of awards day. I don't remember the details, but the principal was there. I think a superintendent was there, and a lot of dignitaries. And the whole school was sitting on the bleachers, on the risers of the school in the gymnasium. So you get, I don't know, 300 kids. They make a lot of racket. So I look at the program, and Peter and I were to present one of his stories from his book. And I look at the program, and they said the Pledge of Allegiance. So I went to the superintendent of schools. I said, hey, look. Peter and I will do the Pledge of Allegiance, because he had written that in his book. He'll say the first line in Dena'ina, and I'll say the English, and we'll work through it that way. He said, no, that won't work, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, I said, no, we're going to do it. So we did. So the kids are rattling, you know, they're at assembly, they're punching one another and pulling pigtails and whatever kids do. I don't know, they still do that? They probably do. And we stand up, and Peter starts out with the first line in Dena'ina of I meant, but then I said it. And it got quieter and quieter, allegiance to the flag. And they didn't know what it meant, and quieter. Here's this old man, native man, speaking a language of the place. And we got done, and the, you know, all hell broke loose again, and they're rattling and talking, and then it came time for our, and I forget which story we read, same thing happened. As he talked, got quieter, and people were third graders, first graders, sixth graders, listening intently, even their teachers. Afterwards, I'm standing talking to somebody, and I look over, and there's about 50 kids standing in front of Peter, reaching their hand out, and he's touching them, one after the other, and then off they would go. Symbolically, I believe, demonstrating that he had something they wanted to know about. He had something that was connected to the place where they were born, where they were raised, where that they were missing. They didn't know what it was, didn't know the language, but knew that he was the key. He was a key to understanding the place they lived. And I'll never forget that particular memory. So what is it that now people growing up are still searching for those understandings of the place where they live and their northern perspectives? They're not something you're going to find in media or literature or anywhere else. It's in the land, it's in the people, it's in the climate, it's in the light. And it's starting to happen. The leaders of the communities need to embrace those ideas, need to allow for this northern culture to develop and not just say, well, you know, I'm going to retire in 4 years. I'm going back to wherever they, Colorado, and they pick a spot. I'll have my retirement. I'm not vested in this place. What should I care? It's a extraction economy anyway. That's disaster. It needs to be embraced for what it is, a northern place of northern people.
That was Dr. Boris sharing a story of going out with Peter Kalifornsky, the Dyna elder Peter Kalifornsky, and sharing those cultural traditions that Dr. Boris spent so much time documenting, learning about. And he did that alongside Dr. James Carey, who also joins us this hour on the Kenai Conversation. Yeah. I want to throw out the numbers here real quick. 394-6397. Again, 394-6397 is the number if you would like to call in and share a story, share some remembrances of Dr. Alan Boris. Dr. Carey, I'm so curious about the time that you spent working with, not just with Dr. Boris, but also with Peter Kalifornsky. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how that process went, where that work began, and really when you understood that maybe there's something pretty special here to be working on.
Well, yes, my ex-wife Priscilla and I first came to Kenai in 1972, and we spent, I'd met Alan by chance in early May 10th or 14th or 12th or something, and we were trying to go to Seldovia first to look for speakers there, and he happened to be in the campground there, and we had this, we spent 6 days in Seldovia because the ferry didn't return to Homer for 6 days. So, but anyway, I was referred to Peter and Bertha Mumfer and Peter's sister Fedosia Sokolov, and around May 20th or so of that year, and I spent 2 weeks working with the three of them every day, and no one had ever shown any interest in the language before. And I was a graduate student in New Mexico at Albuquerque, but we fell in love with Alaska and the people at the time. And then Peter's starting to write. See, he, in about 74 and 75, Peter and Albert Wassily and then Dalton both pick up the writing like in no time at all. And the writing that they did was really very creative and unscripted. It was, and Peter's writing, the fact that he started writing things handwritten in notes, it's really, really interesting. I go through some of his articles or essays and some of these humorous things, or things like translating the Pledge of Allegiance, the Alaska flag. I mean, nobody asked him to do that. Peter's a remarkably original Native American writer in a larger historical sense, more than people realize. It's just a really, really super high level intellectual language, and it cuts across such a range of interests.
And so really a very real look into that world. Dr. Carey, I want to go to the phones. We have someone calling in right now, and I think we can pull him up. Good morning. Welcome to the conversation. Who's this?
My name is Danita Slauson. I've known Alan since 1989, when I was a student at KPC. He was actually the first instructor who came up to me and introduced himself and, helped me to get familiar with the college. And I thought that's so profound to me, because it helped me to get my degree and take a lot of anthropology classes. But the thing was, and I've known Jim Carey since I was a teenager in Tyoonik, and I learning the language and the culture from my elders, my great-grandmother and my aunt and my uncles, was to me the best years of my life. But since they've all passed away, you know, I've been able to work with Alan and Jim Carrey on Dena'ina language, whether it's the stories, the culture. Alan and I actually wrote some papers together, and those were wonderful experiences. But I want to tell one story because it includes an instructor who is also at KPC, Gene Brockle. And Alan and I, we all knew each other, and Gene and I were going over some Dena'ina songs, and she was helping me to put music to the Dena'ina songs. And Alan comes in the room, and he said, "Wow, this is incredible what you're both doing." And he said, "How about both of you sing the Alaska flag song together for graduation?" And Gene looked at him and said, "Alan, only you could think of doing that 2 weeks before graduation." And we all started laughing. And so, but after he left, Gene and I started thinking about it. And we thought if we really worked on it hard, you know, we can really do something with this. And it was a good idea. So we worked on it for 2 solid weeks. And, you know, she was very good with music and piano and singing. And it felt such an honor to be able to sing with her on stage for KPC graduation, you know, and that day. So I just wanted to share that story because it was so indicative of Alan to cultures together and make something spectacular happen. And it's a great loss to all humankind, you know, that he's no longer here. But we can take what we learn from him and continue on his legacy. And that's the jewel of the whole thing. He's taught so many and worked with so many exceptional people, and you know that what we have is from him is something we can continue with our language and culture. So thank you so much for having this program and for letting me share that. Chinan Chikanik.
And
Chinan Shlukud Seat Knife Minhadat. Thank you for listening to me.
And thank you so much, Dena'ina, for calling in and sharing that story. We really appreciate it. And again, for other folks who are trying to get in, 394-6397 is the number. We'll try to get calls in sort of as we go along here. And I wanted to, we've been hearing from Bill Holt, Dr. James Carey, and some callers as well. I wanted to hear from Alan again here really, really quickly. And especially transition into winter, slowly transition into winter. We know that Alan was, as we visited already on this program, a huge proponent of this idea of a culture of the North and embracing the winter season. And he had some thoughts about when people talk about bad weather, and let's listen to that.
Indigenous people inevitably live outside, mostly. So I look around the room, I see a lot of outdoor people. You spend a lot of time outside, but you probably don't spend day after day after day after day outside. So you're really using the house to sleep and cook in bad weather. That's all you need. There's a Swedish proverb that says, there's no bad weather, only bad gear, right? So you know, most of you know as well as I, you can spend all day outside. You know how to use the gear. And you got to know how to use the gear.
And we're going to see if we can get back to the phones. I believe we had a call coming in. Good morning. Welcome to the conversation. Who's this?
Sandra Shaganoff Stewart.
Good morning, Sandra.
Hi. I really wanted to share a story about Alan. I work here at the college, and I've known Alan for a long time. I worked with Alan when he had his first Dena'ina class with Peter Kalifornsky. And I was a student there and was encouraged to learn about the Dena'ina language, but also encouraged to learn about my own language, which is Otna. He always encouraged us to learn our own language and learn about our own identity. And help us in our classes here at college, but also us as Native people here at KPC. It was very much a strong component here at the college that he helped us to have a voice here in the university system. And he was very encouraging and also a bridge for many of us here on the Kenai Peninsula. I know he worked closely with the Kenaitse Indian tribe and was a honorary tribal member. And he held that very dear to his heart. And he will be very much missed here.
Sandra, thank you so much for calling in today. So good to hear from you and so good to hear those warm stories and warm remembrances again of our friend, Dr. Alan Boris. Wanted to switch gears a little bit. We've had another guest come into the studio to join us this morning. And if George Hawley is with us, and George, always so good to see you. And thank you so much for coming in. This is a sad time, but again, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, yes. Don't get down.
And there's really no end to the impact that Dr. Boris had, and we're seeing that over the last few days as folks write in, call in, and we hear these stories. Bill, I wanted to get back to you a little bit and talk about, you know, we're hearing a lot about bridging communities and community building, and that was something that very much was at the heart of everything that Alan was doing, if maybe not always explicitly. And the Salteshi Trails are such a huge representative sort of thing that you can point to as something that really represented all those things and all that work. And I don't know, did you get a sense of him being particularly conscious of that as the trail system grew, or was it just sort of a hobby that maybe got out of hand a little bit?
Well, I really feel like the trails were something that came from Alan's heart. It wasn't just, I think Clark said it really well, that he did not do anything impulsively, and everything he did was as a teacher. And I think that he had a vision there that was something that very few people really saw at first. But his vision was very much what everything we've heard him say today was to bring people back into the presence of the earth and to give people a way to really connect with the world around them and the world that we live in here, the reality of the world that we live in here. And so that was my experience with Alan working on the trails. I feel like in a lot of ways he was a mentor to me, but he was actually bringing out a love of land, a love of being. And he did that very purposefully, like he did everything in his life. He was a very purposeful person. And to me, he awoke that in other people too, a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning, and a sense of presence. And so I think, to get back to the trails, I think that Alan saw something there that was a way to unify our culture in this area, a way to give us a gift of being connected to nature. And he went about that very purposefully. He invited people in. If you were not too excited to join in, that was fine with Alan. He would just keep working, and he was so tenacious about doing things the right way. There was a lot of argument at one point whether to name this trail Salteshi Trails. A lot of people thought we should call that the Soldotna Trails. And Alan, because he was so kind of magnanimous in his thinking, he really wanted to tie in the experience of the trails with the native culture that's here and the experience of being in the north and sharing nature. And what he was just saying about I don't know exactly what it was. There's no bad weather. There's just bad gear or something like that.
Right.
That's so much the kind of thing that he would say a lot as we worked on building those trails. Of course, he started way before I did, but he drew me into his big heart and his vision of what could be here. And he just held that. He always held that. And it's something that I'll never, uh, that that I feel like he has given to a lot of us. And I think it's been a real gift to our community and a gift to me personally.
Absolutely. He gave so much and worked so hard. And a quick little bit, you know, he was so prolific in the work that he did sort of across the spectrum. Just last week, still had papers published within the university system. So there was no end to the amount of energy that he brought to anything that he wanted to work on and get done and help share with people. That's for sure. George Hawley, again, joining us in the studio. And George, do you have any thoughts? Anything you'd like to say?
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. Doga Din. You know, thank you for those words about him wanting to bring us all into the presence of the earth. You know, because I do believe that, you know, anyone who was lucky enough to be his Facebook friend, for instance, you know, we would see these gorgeous photographs that he would take out on walks with his dog. And he would talk about the names of the different places, speaking of Saltashu Trails. And it always, you know, gave me a sense that, wow, this is a person who, you know, learned. He really learned something, you know, from his life here. And, yeah, he studied it and he helped, you know, to propagate that learning, but he really like took it in him, and he took it, you know, on a real personal level, and that like was, he just really conveyed and beamed that out from him. I met him when I was probably 11 or 12, and I was in the sixth grade, and it was in Zeta Friedersdorf's class at Readout Elementary, and we were asked to do like a paper on some local person on what they did, and I went to visit Alan Boris at his office at KPC and talked with him about you know being in a place and studying people that live in a place, and you know that, like, all these years later, I ran across him again and reminded him. I said, Alan, do you know that I was a kid when I first met you and came into your office and interviewed you? And, you know, he was just so pleasant. He was always just, you know, so kind. And he said, yeah, I remember that. And that was just like such a win in my heart, you know, to think, wow. You know, he spoke at the Rasmussen Museum, you know, some years ago. And people opened it up, you know, for comment later. And I stood up and I just had to thank him, you know, in front of those folks for, you know, his work in our Native community, you know, his endless advocating and using, you know, his education, his, you know, just his knowledge and person and his unique kind of insight, you know, to always find creative ways to be able to defend and assert Native rights and Native spirit. And, you know, he was just a unique man among us that I believe is a healing figure in all kinds of ways.
And the message, excuse me, the message that I tended to get from him in my years talking to him about a range of subjects, whether we were doing a formal interview about something or, again, stopping by the anthropology lab to just try to solve the world's problems, was the idea of sustainability and looking to the past for lessons for the future. And that was something that was so prominent in his work. And I think we've got another call coming in here, so we can go to the phones. Good morning. Welcome to the conversation. Who's this? Good morning.
Hi, Shailen.
Good morning, Catherine. Thank you so much for calling
in. Hi, Bill.
In.
Hi, George. I'm not really good at speaking impromptu, so I wrote something. Dr. Alan Boris said that we raise to the sacred that which is most important in our lives. For the last few days since he's died, I've been thinking about what's sacred to me. Dr. Boris taught me so much in the past 5 years that he's been my mentor and teacher in my anthropological career. It's been a huge privilege to be his student and work in the lab because I feel like I was afforded the opportunity to learn from one of the greatest, someone who's lived his work. His compassion for others and dedication to his work is something I hope to emulate for the rest of my life and to continue his legacy to make our community a better place. He's affected our lives in such a way, especially the younger generation that was born and grew up here with parents that have moved from out of state. I went to Skyview High School and skied on Salteshi ski trails from 7th grade to a senior in high school. And even before I met him, he was affecting my life. He was influencing the very way that I lived and taught me the importance of enjoying the outdoors and really respecting nature. And I would see this guy just skiing around on the trails in this big red jumpsuit and wondered, who is this guy? And it turned out to be Dr. Boris. And there he was, you know, just being there in our lives. And I'd like to end on a favorite excerpt of Dr. Boris's from the poem Turtle Island by Gary Snyder.
Of course.
Stay together, learn the flowers, and go light. Thank you for having me on, Shaylin.
Thank you, Catherine, so much for calling in. We appreciate it, and so lovely to hear those warm sentiments. The last few days, that feeling has been, I think we've all shared that feeling a little bit. And George, do you have a song you'd like to share?
Yes, Dogaden, thank you so much. You know, I took to heart, you know, some of the things that were in that book, the Dena'ina Sukdu'a, Dena'ina Legacy, that he and Peter, you know, that they collaborated on. And, you know, there's such a beautiful painting that at the university of him and Peter together. So out on in Kalifornsky village, he'd be talking about Peter and the life and the people there. And if he saw me there, he would turn and say, George, how about a song? Well, you know, I put to music something from that book. And I believe it's on page 419 of that book. And that is that prayer that Dr. Carey referred to. It's a single line from it. And, you know, I think that that it says a lot about this man and in this day. It, I'll sing it for you.
Hey, ah, hey, ah, hey, ah, hey, ah, hey, ah, hey, oh, hey, ah, hey, hey, ah, 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 Hadach Nel Nesh Nakaltani Che Yohaina. We all verily worship God. We all verily worship God. We
That is from A Prayer for the Departed. And so I'll see you further on down that trail, Dr. Boris.
George, thank you so, so much for sharing that with us. We're more than out of time, and I'm totally fine with that. What I would like to do, though, is just quickly thank everyone who has joined us this morning. Dr. Carey, if you're still with us, thank you so much for being with us this morning and sharing some of your remembrances and stories of Dr. Boris. We really did appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here. Yeah.
And Bill Holt and George Holloway, thank you so much for being in the studio this morning. Always wonderful to see both of you, of course. I want to, just as we end the program here, my sense, the little that I did get to know Dr. Boris, is that he had a very holistic thought about the cycle of life, and he's simply in another part of that cycle of life right now. And as we end the program, would like to air a little bit from a lecture that he gave talking about how we process grief.
Grief. We don't know how to grieve today. Or at least we're not taught how to grieve. We don't know how to do it. Some of you know how to do it, but I certainly don't. Traditional culture believed that when a person died, they then knew your thoughts. So, I don't know what you're thinking right now. Pretty sure I don't want to know what you're thinking right now. But to believe that some loved one now knows your thoughts is, shall we say, challenging. So it's not necessarily a comfortable thing. That's the function of the potlatch. So you've heard the term potlatch. It occurred up and down the coast. Early anthropologists misunderstood the potlatch, thinking it was a redistribution of wealth through gift giving, which it was, but it wasn't the purpose of it. The purpose was to say through gifts, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for the thoughts I had. I'm sorry for the things we did not resolve in life. We should have, and hence I give these gifts to your relatives to say how I'm sorry. And then it was okay. Things were okay.
And Alan had a way of making things okay. We want to thank everyone who called in today and shared remembrances and stories. And again, our deepest condolences to Alan's family. Thanks for being with us this morning. I'm Shaylin Cochran.